We're back at it, Al. Today, our title of the pod is Ego is Not the Enemy.
Yeah, I love that. Comes from two things, this one, when we were thinking about the title.
And Laurie Kerner talked very much about leaving ego at the door, which I'm a massive fan on, by the way. Then we had Alistair McGraw on, who sort of described needing a bit of ego to do your job. And then we've looked at the book from Ryan Halliday, who talks a lot about Stoic principles, that ego is the enemy. So there's a few things we're flying around with today. We'll have a good discussion, and then maybe at the end, we'll tell them what we think.
So do we think today's discussion is more about how much ego is too much ego?
Oh, it might be, might it? It might be. You know my thoughts on this. I'm very much in Laurie's camp of leaving ego at the door. I think ego has more negative connotations than positive.
I'm going to start off with one of my favourite quotes. Mentioned this one before. The way you do anything is the way you do everything. Which alludes to the fact that if you're trying to do a good job with something, it probably suggests that that's the kind of way that you approach everything else in your life. You want to try and...
Do you need ego for that?
Yes, why, I think
why,
so.
Why?
And for me, this is the argument for ego. Ego is... I think ego can be a very, very positive and a good thing because it allows you to have accountability and pride in something that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example. Let's say that you're involved in a project in school. It can be any project, pick your project, anything that you can consider that you've been involved in. If you have a little bit of ego and your name's attached to that project, are you more likely to want that project to succeed?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay.
But isn't that just doing your job? Does that need ego?
It depends how much of a cynic you want to be about that question, doesn't it? Because you can easily go through the motions of something and think, well, I don't really care whether this works or not. Now, if you go into everything with zero ego, not worried whether it works or not, actually, the first sign of it not working, are you not more likely to think, oh, it's not worked, never mind?
This comes back to defining what ego is, mate. And as I've just said, I think ego, in my lived experiences and my views of what that word means, it sort of comes from when you use the phrase, he's got a bit of ego about him, where it's a confidence bordering arrogance, in my view. What do you think?
I think you've made up that definition yourself.
Yeah, I am. That's not a dictionary definition.
Yeah, that's it. I'm just looking
at it. That's what I think. That's what my negative thoughts of ego is that.
So if somebody says he's got an ego to you, you think, oh, then he must be arrogant and...
Well, yeah, and selfish and lacks humility or think they know best, or I just don't enjoy being around that kind of character. So again, it's my own bias that sort of puts a different slant on the word ego.
So I'm going off the Oxford Dictionary definition here, which, to be fair, is pretty much where my preconception was. I'm just reading this as we're recording. Ego is a person's sense of self-esteem or self-importance. Mm. I would have said before looking at that it's about how much confidence somebody has, which I suppose is related. So maybe we clarify it. As we talk about ego from now on, we're talking about a person's sense of self-esteem or self-importance.
Mm.
Does that change your opinion?
It's a good definition. It does be that, you know. Do you know what a person who writes a dictionary is, by the way? I learned this week. I love learning.
Him off Blackadder.
It's a lexicographer.
Do you remember the guy off Blackadder who wrote the dictionary?
Is that right? Yeah, I remember that.
I was never into Blackadder as a kid, but I remember watching it in a history lesson.
But
we were just looking into your hilarious episode about the guy that's writing a dictionary. I remembered his name for a long time. Was it Johnson or Jackson? Who wrote the first ever dictionary? Carry on, I'll find out as we go.
Those lexicographers who write dictionaries, well, they're going to have biases as well, aren't they? So, like, why is their definition right?
Yes, they are. You're right. He is a lexicographer. Yeah. And why is their definition right? I suppose in today's day and age, I'm sure that there are all sorts of different things that feed into the definition of a word.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting to see how the definition of words has changed over the years, because it is about perceptions and such.
We talked about zest a couple of weeks ago, didn't
we did, yeah.
On the pod. I didn't realise you looked in our mission and vision for the school we're currently working in, and it has zest in it.
Is it?
Yeah, it's about how you perform with zest.
Yeah.
And want to create students that perform with zest.
And in what context is zest meant for our mission?
Well, the Urban Dictionary now and the sixth formers were killing themselves when we were talking about zest, and it's now much more addressed in a homosexual manner.
Okay.
So different, completely different to what previous meanings, and that's how language changes over time.
And to go back to what I was mentioning earlier, you'll be impressed with this. It was Johnson, Samuel Johnson, was the guy who wrote the first dictionary of the English language. Do you know what year that was in?
Oh, that's a great show. The first dictionary.
Yeah, the first edition dictionary of the English language. The first English dictionary.
1500s?
No.
When?
1755.
Oh, that's late.
There was no sort of central sort of record. And I imagine that wasn't a central record for a few years. But anyway, we digress a little bit.
No, it's good.
Now we know what ego is. We can continue the conversation with clarity. Ego is somebody's self-confidence or self-esteem. So going back to the point I was making a little bit earlier, I think you've got to have a little bit of ego to put your name on something. And when your name is on something, you've got to have a little bit of ego to make sure that you know that you're going to be held accountable for that. You know, I think a little bit of us as human beings comes from the idea of being mammals in a tribe. You don't want to be the weakest in the tribe. You don't want to be the one that's ostracized. You want to fit in and you want to do well and you want to show your worth in life. You want to show that you've actually got something to offer. And I think that having a little bit of ego is important when it comes to the way that you do your work and the fact that you're taking accountability for what you're doing.
Agree with you. And when you think back to some of those studies done on tribes, the leaders there led with humility, but they also led having evidence that shows that they could have some ego because they'd done the stuff that they were doing previously. So an example of that, using the tribe, they're out hunting as an example. Everybody there who had that ego to go out and hunt, to go and have that confidence to make the kill, they've actually got the evidence, they've made the kill, they've come back, they've brought it back to the people, they share it, they've proved their worth.
Mm.
So for me, yes, that you can have a little bit of ego, I think, when you've proven your worth,
yeah.
And you've got, again, coming back to our last pod, success leaves clues,
mm.
You've got evidence that you have actually done the job and you've done it well, and you can have that confidence to then take that forward. Where it gets me is if where people have not got the evidence and they're trying to give it the big one, as we call it, without any sort of back history of showing what they can do. That's where I don't like that particularly.
So is that where confidence turns into arrogance?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I agree with that part about evidence and knowledge and what do you actually know? What are you contributing?
Yes.
So, you know, let's put yourself in an example where you're speaking, we're talking about what we're talking here, right?
Yeah.
And on the couch next to us, we've got a behavioral psychologist who studied this academically and in practice for 25 years. You know, I think if that person's going to give us the research and the evidence and tell us where we're right and where we're wrong, we need to show the humility to be like, to listen.
Yeah, you're right.
Exactly right. And to take on board what they're saying. But I think it's important people realise that. There's always somebody that knows more than you, right?
Yeah, completely.
There always is. And that's why it's worth listening when you're in conversations with people that are passionate about a subject or knowledgeable about a subject. Yeah. Listen to them.
Yeah.
Listen to them because you might learn something as you go along. And, you know, if along with that they have a little bit of ego, in some ways, from my perspective, yeah, it might be a bit abrasive, but you sort of let them have it, don't you? Because actually, they know their stuff and they've got a track record that proves it. They can back it up.
Agree. But you've also got your own values there. You might not necessarily, they might have all the evidence and so on and so on. There must have been thousands of scientists many years ago that were trying to prove flat Earth theory.
Mm.
The guy comes along, whoever it was, I remember the time, to prove about the Earth being round.
That's a key part in this conversation.
But there again, the evidence here, but that will have been laughed out of town until opinions changed. And then the flat earthers are laughed out of town, aren't they?
But that's it. But that's a really interesting one. And the fact that if you're ever the first to suggest something, you're the person who's lost it. Yeah. You're the lunatic.
Yeah.
If you're the last person to accept something, you're also the lunatic. So you need to fall somewhere in between, right?
Remember that video from the festival years and years ago where the guy goes up and starts dancing? And he's dancing like just having a dance on his own.
Right.
And everybody thinks, ooh, what's this guy doing? He's a nutter. And then the second person joins.
Yeah.
And then the third. And then the fourth.
Yeah.
And the fifth. And then all of a sudden they see a group and everybody goes.
Mm.
So it's about following, having that bit of ego there to go up and have a dance, not be bothered about looking stupid.
Yeah.
Then incited followers, which is an interesting way of looking. See, we're saying in our positions in schools as a leader, you have to have a little bit of ego to make people follow you. Is that what? That could be fair enough?
Possibly, but I think that, yeah, I would agree with that. And I think we go back to that idea that if that ego is based on evidence, knowledge and experience and successes, if that ego is based on just a huge inflated, overinflated feeling of self-worth and confidence that really doesn't come from anywhere other than hope and conjecture, I think that's really, really different, right?
Yeah,
so you can have the most charismatic leader in the world, but let's give a school example. You have the most charismatic head teacher in the world, but if that head teacher really isn't engaged and interested in education and doesn't have a track record of learning and wanting to improve and applying different initiatives that make an impact, then actually it's empty, isn't it?
No, you're completely right.
You're just following a gobshite.
Effectively. But then there's the other side to that, isn't there? Where that person might be the most research, evidence-backed person in the world, incredible pedigree, real love for kids. But he's like, but with no charisma, would you follow?
That's it. It's tough. And I tell you what, as human beings, more people would follow example number one than example number two.
Oh, we're not seeing that in the world.
Which is tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we've seen that with populism, haven't we?
Mm.
And the fact, I mean, we've lived in a country where famous actors and sports people have become politicians because of their charisma, not necessarily because of their political upbringing and knowledge of systems and how to put things in place. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And you could pick apart all sorts of different examples, but I wonder where that line is between where people see and respect others and think that's great. They've got confidence in their ability and they can back it up, as opposed to, you know, that's arrogance and selfishness and it's careless and it's reckless. And I wonder where that line is. And I think the short answer to answer my own question would be it differs for everyone, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
But in a school context, how do you know how much ego is enough ego? How do you know when there's too much on the line?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for me, you think about a young teacher, and we were both, well, if we take ourselves back to when we were 21, 22. At that age, you do think you know everything, don't you?
Absolutely. I was horrendous at receiving things back then. I was like, go on, try and find something wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd get really annoyed. There'd be loads wrong with it. And I'd get so frustrated. I'd be like, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know why you're being picky.
Yeah, completely. As a young teacher and as a young man or woman, it is hard at that point to receive that feedback and to move that forward and think, how am I going to get better from it? And be reflective. I think you only start getting reflective as you move through into your 30s and 40s. But I think from a school perspective, it's recognising that everybody's so different and everybody's at different stages, particularly as teachers. And then putting that down towards children. You go into nursery. Like, who's good at drawing? What happens?
No, every single one of them.
Brilliant, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then you're, from our subject, you're in with primary. Who can play football? And there's about three that can kick a ball. But where does that then? It stops, doesn't it? Because they get to senior and suddenly self-consciousness happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you say you're good at this, and then be very few that would ever own up to saying I'm good at something.
It happens about year three, year four. I think.
You reckon it happens? Do you think it happens then?
I think it does. And I think probably more worryingly, it's I felt like it's getting younger and younger.
Oh, dear.
Now, in some respects, that's a good thing. You want people to be aware of what their strengths and their areas to develop are, but
you don't want to lose hope.
You want someone at 6 years old to be
I'm rubbish.
To be losing hope and thinking, well, I'm no good because that person's better than me.
I know, that's awful, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think about that. So we little ones need a little bit of ego then. And it's quite we're saying it's quite nice to think, oh, I'm really good at I'm the best in the world at drawing. I'm really good at this. I really like it. Need a little bit then, don't you?
Yeah.
To kick you on rather than being like just Debbie Downer sort of. I'm not very good at this.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
And again, I think all that it depends on the experiences and the atmosphere and environment. Excuse me, that you're growing up in and that you're around, right?
I suppose there's a context here as well, though. That self-awareness we always talk about. When people think they're really good, so let's say a teacher thinks that they're very strong at giving feedback to children, but an experienced practitioner goes in and observes, and they're not.
Yeah.
They're not as good as they could be.
Yeah.
Or they're not as good as they are. They're not as good as an experienced practitioner would be. Now, that's where that conversation's got to happen, hasn't it? And the feedback that is given, do you take into account that they have a little bit of ego? So every conversation you have, you're dealing with the individual person. And are you trying to stroke their ego? Are you trying to put your sort of carrot and stick? Is it an arm round? It comes back to knowing how much ego that they've got in the room at that time.
It does. And I think it comes back to, like you said earlier, values. I'll give you an example. A school I used to work in, I was speaking to one of the deputy heads, assistant principals, and he was involved in an interview with a member of staff at the school. So it was an internal promotion. And he didn't give the job to the person who applied. And in the feedback meeting, the person that applied for the job basically stopped him halfway through the feedback and said, I don't really care what you think. I'm not bothered. I don't think I'll ever speak to you again while you're at this school. I think it's disgusting you didn't give me the job.
What the hell?
Yeah, right. Which is interesting, isn't it, as a take on it. Now, I don't know whether to this day that's happened or not. I'm not sure of the follow-up. But the ego there, where do you think the ego is in that room?
Well, you would expect it's with that person not wanting to receive feedback.
Well, yeah, that would be my first thought. But if that person lacks the self-awareness of knowing that, they've probably perceived the person interviewing them as having the ego.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Because they've got a problem with their interview and they've got a problem with actually how they do things.
So it's all perception-based.
It is perception-based, but I think it probably highlights that need for self-awareness that actually, if there's somebody in a field who's got a different perspective to you and they're experienced and they know what they're talking about, again, shut up and listen. You might not agree with them, but shut up and listen and you might learn something as you go along.
Agree. And I also want to flip it back to that person who was leading that feedback. Did they know the person well enough to know if their ego needs stroking or does it need checking? And I think that's a key thing for any leaders who are listening to talk, prospective leaders, is knowing your staff and knowing where you're sort of on an could we put an ego continuum? Is that where on that continuum is that person's ego? If they're confident, are they feeling a bit low at the moment with their confidence? Has there been a trauma? So where are we at there? Or are they at the point where they've been a little bit arrogant, they're thinking they know it all and it just needs checking and you just need bringing back down to earth a little bit?
Yeah.
There's a continuum, I think, here. Anyway, I think we're onto something here. There's the ego continuum of where you're at. And I think you could be at different places on that ego continuum, couldn't you? As a person.
Yeah, you could. And you could walk into that room giving it all the front in the world, but feeling really fragile and thinking, I really hope that this feedback doesn't destroy me.
Yeah.
But I think that comes back to our role as leaders in schools. If you're going to, you do the right thing for the person in front of you, don't you?
Yeah.
And sometimes that's difficult, but sometimes that is the right thing to do. And if you can sit across from somebody and use your experience and knowledge and perceptions to help them understand what your thoughts about their performance was, then that's a really brave thing to do. And I think you've got to have as much respect for the person giving that as you have for receiving it. And yeah, I think it's important that we role model that as well. And if people give leaders in schools feedback, then, you know, they should be willing to take that on board. Mm. You never want a silent staff that isn't upfront and isn't forward in coming and saying, listen, there's a few things I want to report or feedback to you or give my perspective on. And equally, you should be forthcoming in asking them for that perspective, right?
Yeah. So it's about their honesty and clarity. And when we're talking, it's not personal. It's not about the person. It's maybe the actions or the behaviours. It's not about character assassinating.
Yeah, you don't need to assassinate character. If you've got decent relationships and personal skills, you've done it really well in how you said that. You can depersonalize it. You're not attacking them as a person. You're attacking, or maybe attacking is the wrong word, but you're pointing out the decisions they've made or the way that they've done specific things or the way they've communicated. It's all about skills.
Yeah.
It's not about them as a person.
Yeah,
and I think as an adult, as you get older, you realize that, you know, life, it's that journey that never ends when you're in it.
Yeah.
And when it does end, you won't know about it, right?
Yeah.
So there's no point putting an end point on things. It's just taking the feedback, learning and going again, You know, there isn't a sort of, at the end of the year, this is where I'll be and I've passed or failed. There might be a pass or a fail within a specific syllabus or curricular area or something you're doing, but in the grand scheme of things, there never is. It just goes again.
I'm going to circle back round to at the start when you talked about ego, about being proud of what you're doing and having pride to do the job well.
Yeah.
When I think now of the word pride, maybe it's my mindset, I've also got negative connotations with that word as well. I think there's some significant positives about trying to do the best you can.
Right.
I love that. But we've worked in countries where pride, as that word, has also got in the way of success, hasn't it? And we can probably think of loads of examples of where, you know, your pride.
Okay.
And being in this part of the world, there is a significant amount of Arab pride where if you've made a mistake, certainly in the Philippines, this, where we had
face in the Philippines.
Face, is that what it is? Is that what
lose
face?
I don't know the Tagalog phrase, but it's essentially it's losing face. You know, you don't want to lose face in front of other people. You want to keep that sort of equilibrium and your position in society.
Well, and I fully get that, and it's a wonderful place to live and love being there.
Mm.
But it was frustrating at times when we, can you do that for me? Do you understand what has to be done?
Mm.
What was the usual answer?
Yes, sir.
And what happened was is that the job wouldn't get done very well or not at all, but they didn't want to say no.
Mm.
And I find that I sit here where in this part of the world, there is situations where something's happened where the job might not be great or it's not what you'd expect.
Mm.
But you wouldn't want to point that out because it would affect their pride so much that your relationship would be hurt by that.
Mm.
So you've got to sort of not beat around this, sort of skirt around the edges. Do you know what I mean? And then build a relationship first and then develop the skills as you move through your working relationship. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a real tough line.
It is, yeah, but there's cultural knowledge.
Yeah, it's about knowing and living in these places.
I remember so many examples in BSM and talking about the sort of the Philippines in specifically, where there'd be a member of staff who was a local member of staff, Filipino member of staff, who I'd be speaking to. And then suddenly one day, like, they wouldn't speak to me, or I'd see them and they'd walk the other way and I'd think, well, what's going on here? And it wasn't for a little while, maybe months, even years, until I realised that if that's happening, everyone else knows about the problem, but you won't know about the problem.
Oh.
So you'd speak to somebody and they'd be like, oh, yeah, well, I know why that person's doing that. It's because of this decision you made. And you're like, ah, right, okay. Never had any idea about that. Very different to where you work normally, maybe, let's say, in England, where if you upset someone, they'd probably be quite forward in letting you know quite early. but when you actually found out what the problem was and you went and confronted that problem and had a conversation with that person, everything was right as rain again. in 2 minutes. 2 minutes later, because there was a line drawn under it, and it.
But
was
not helped. Until you put it right, though.
But not until, yeah, no, but not necessarily whether you put it right. It was more about the conversation that you had. But it was really interesting to learn that was normal. That wasn't in any way being disrespectful to the person that's made that decision that was disagreed with. That was just sort of normal and how people dealt with it.
Yeah.
So to just understand that, you know, humbles you a little bit, because you're like, right, okay, well, I'm not going to change that. There's no way I'm going to make a difference in changing that culture.
Yeah.
Because that's so deeply ingrained. But at least knowing about it, we can come up with different ways in which we can manage it, you know.
I mean, the examples here, isn't it? You wouldn't want to offend a Saudi person by not having a coffee or a tea with them if it was offered. If you were to sit down, that's a big cultural no.
I don't even know if that's a Saudi thing, man.
But
I don't know, it's Saudi. And if you went to her house and had a cup of tea, she'd think you're a bit strange.
But if you're attending a meeting here and you've got the formalities for this, you're not straight down to business.
No, yeah, no.
It's shoot, just have a little bit of a polite conversation first. Drink the tea, eat the dates, make some chat, some nice idle chat. And it's etiquette then not to go straight down to it.
Yeah.
And I think we have to adapt, don't we? And I think it's important that when we're talking about ego, is not saying, well, my culture is going to trump your culture, therefore we're going to do that. It's about acknowledging where you're at that time, and the context here is so important.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of two brilliant examples. One that a colleague shared with me about his time in Japan, and how, you know, not addressing his elders in the correct way, in the right order in the morning, would mean that for the whole day there was an atmosphere and a conflict, because it's so deeply ingrained and so respectful to make sure that there were certain phrases that were said to certain people, placed on the hierarchy of the school management, but also based on the seniority of elders in Japan.
Yeah.
I've been to Japan once, but I don't understand that well enough to sort of make specific examples, but that was one that really stuck with me.
Remember Karina, though?
I'm just about
to say that.
So the other one was our colleague, Todd and Karina, who worked with us. Lovely, lovely people. And Karina's Ukrainian. And it's that idle phrase of, how are you doing? How are you? And Karina shared with us, and I was really surprised at this, that if that's the case in the Ukraine and you ask people how they are, it's a sincere question that requires, you know, a couple of minutes and a proper chat. Whereas here, it's like, how are you doing as you walk past the corridor? And she found that quite difficult when she first worked in a British
school. And every time I see her in school, and I ask it's just natural. So, how are you doing? You're all right. And now I have to actually physically make sure I have a minute or two to follow up. To follow up, how are you?
Or you walk past with a very intentional hello.
That's brilliant. So let's just think about here then. So if ego is not the enemy, have we established ego is not the enemy?
I don't know what we've established. We've had a nice chat, haven't we?
If ego is not the enemy, what is?
That's a little question for you. I've got some stuff down.
Yeah, go on.
And then you can elaborate on it. So if ego is not the enemy, fear of failure is not admitting mistakes, is trying to be something you're not, is, and then avoiding showing vulnerability is.
Well, I like that one.
They're my, what I think, if ego's not the enemy, and we're talking about having self-awareness and having humility and integrity, then the enemy is those things, in my view. Failure, not admitting mistakes, trying to be something you're not, and not showing, not having the sort of the confidence to show vulnerability, which we've talked about before. I do think comes much later in life.
Being in the arena.
Yeah.
I'd add two onto those, or they might be sort of subsections to what you said. Ego is not the enemy, but stopping learning is.
Mm.
Or that's not phrased very well, but you get the idea of being in a position where
you know it all.
You think you know it all, so you've just sort of stagnated the point. And the other one he touched upon but didn't explicitly say, which for me is self-awareness. Ego's not the enemy, but a lack of self-awareness.
Nice. That's a nice phrase.
You know, how often do you meet people sometimes and you think, wow, you've no idea how you're perceived by others? Where it's not always your job or specifically to tell them, but it's interesting.
Do you think that's an interesting one? You think we should have that conversation? I remember having it with a child, actually.
Yeah.
And we just put up on the board, how do you think you've, as an individual, not even for the class, by the way,
yeah.
just having a mentoring chat of how do you think you're perceived by others?
Yeah.
And actually got some data in from other people where they put some keywords down about what they thought of that person.
Yeah.
And what they thought was completely different to the data that we'd collected.
Yeah.
And it was a real wake-up call. You could see almost a light bulb moment. Wow, they think that of me.
Wow.
When I thought I was doing this.
Yeah.
Really cool. I haven't done it with an adult, by the way. I wondered, that'd be interesting. We do an interview, don't we? Say, how do others perceive you?
Yeah.
Quite like that on interview.
I just thought of that interview question, but I thought, yeah, you know what? What about an interview question that says, how did your references describe you?
Oh, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to use that one, I think, because that's essentially the same thing, isn't it? But
yeah,
then they're going to come across that in a, I'd imagine, address it in a very professional way. But we know for a fact that we get many references through across our desk that are honest, and I so appreciate an honest reference.
Yeah.
You know,
or a phone call.
It's brilliant to have them, and now references have obviously got this sort of shrouded mystery around them where they always have to be written and you can only focus on the positives. Well, it's true to a certain extent, but if there are certain things that an employer has to know about a person, then you've got a responsibility to make sure that that's known. Now, sometimes employers make that much more accessible, don't they? Because they're sending you sort of checklists and questionnaires and you can rate certain areas of certain people's performance from your perception. And you have to remember it is just one person's perception, but when you've got that sort of question in there of how do you feel your references described you, it gives that person a moment to pause and think, right, okay, well, I have no idea what they've shared with them.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good one.
And that Simon Sinek question that you talked about the other week, which was about, you know, I don't like surprises. Something to come up that I didn't know about. So what should I know about you?
Yeah, really good. I've been doing that one this week.
They're both terrific questions in terms of self-awareness, aren't they?
Yeah. Stephen Bartlett does the one where he, what can you tell us that would help us to understand how you can work effectively in our team?
Yeah, yeah.
So we had some belting ones this week. Someone said, I really like clarity and I really like structure and order. So if my head of department can provide me with those things, I work really well under that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? That didn't come up at any other point in the interview, but it gives you an indication of what they're about.
Yeah.
Another one said that they really like praise. And it makes you think that, yeah, we all like praise, but they actually explicitly said, I really like to be praised for the work I do and to be appreciated.
Brilliant.
And it's getting to the depth of that, isn't it? And then we're not presuming, are we? We know what we're getting,
yeah.
And then ego is not the enemy.
No. You know? And that helps usually within these meetings. Within these interviews, you have the person who's going to be their immediate line manager in those interviews most of the time, right?
Mm.
So that's really useful for them to know as well. And I wonder how many people on a percentage of teachers across the world that have sit in those meetings and care enough to write that down and think, right, well, when they first come in, I'm going to make a point of doing that.
Yeah, that's a really good.
And how much of it is lost,
yeah.
You know? Let's start to finish this one off and talk about how, you know, some things that we can do to show that we've got confidence and self-esteem, but not necessarily arrogance and superiority. And I'm going to start you off with one from Butlins. In around 2009, maybe, I went to Butlins with the school I worked for at the time. And Sir Geoff Hurst was presenting the awards. It wasn't a jolly my Butlins trip. It was a sports tournament. It was a football tournament. Sir Geoff Hurst, World Cup winner, was on the stage giving out the awards. And what was incredible was when I walked up there, so you went up there and like they introduced the coach or the manager of the team. And there you got maybe like 20 seconds to have a quick chat with him, right? And I went up there just before the lads in the team came up, and the first thing he said to me, what do you think the first thing he said to me was?
All right, lad.
He said, well, it wasn't that. He said, hi, what's your name? Okay. Great start. I'm Lewis. Okay. Lovely to meet you. My name's Geoff Hurst. I knew Geoff Hurst was right. It had been announced on the microphone. There was a big banner with his name on. I'd recognize him anyway. But to have the humility of not presuming that I know his name.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was brilliant. I thought that's such a nice thing to do. And I think that there's lots of connections there with, again, when you're being interviewed by heads of school, when heads of school are leading meetings, assemblies, you know, if you're going into a meeting yourself with parents, not assuming that they know who you are, but just taking a moment to introduce yourself. And that'll stick with me forever. Not least because he's an absolute legend, of course, for what he did in the World Cup for England. But the humility of that, like, everyone.
I mentioned Chris Wilder for a while, but I am still. Remember when it was probably must be 5 years ago now. It seems like yesterday. But it was the opening day of getting the kits.
Yes.
And I took Zach and Gracie down.
Yeah.
The first day, like opening up, get down there early so that they don't sell out. Well, they're not going to sell out, but they're still queuing around car park, to be fair, to Chip United.
Yeah.
And we got there, and Chris Wilder's on the door. We're talking, he's the manager.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that anywhere else in any football club.
No.
Where the manager is on the door, like 8 a.m., shaking hands with everybody, every support that comes in to buy a kit and saying thanks for buying the kit and having a picture.
Mm.
That kills me, stuff like that. It's just phenomenal. Because he didn't have to do that.
No, he didn't. But the legacy of him doing that, and we'll not go into Sheffield United stuff for too long, but like Wilder's not at the club anymore. There's still loads of rumours he might come back one day. But the main thing what happened there was he took over a club whose fan base was broken. It was struggling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, numbers were down on the gate. Now, even though Wilder's left, the numbers have still continued to be really good.
Yeah.
So he's left the legacy there of suddenly connecting with his fans again, which I think was just so needed. And that's helped the success of the club since.
But even when we went to meet him, he must have spent, 2 hours shaking hands, talking to people, saying hello, arm round photo.
Yeah, it was a long time, wasn't it?
Phenomenal. And I think that, for me, linked back to teaching and what we do in schools, is doing the things that are the unseen stuff, like going out on the duty, greeting in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, great advice for any aspiring leader, go and do that.
Yeah.
Make connections, learn names. We've talked about that before, haven't we? Saying hello, making a mistake, but it's all right.
Yeah.
Going on duties, doing the walk-arounds on duties. After assembly, put the chairs away. Don't leave it for your operation staff. Go and do it.
Yeah.
Do the things, do the little things that get noticed.
Yeah.
Right. Not for being noticed, say, but because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Clearing things up after an event is massive. If you're the leader and you've just disappeared and leave it to everybody else, what kind of image does that set off?
Mm.
That shows your ego, you aren't too important for that.
Yeah.
And I always took that from what we saw with Simon on episode number one, where he was always there when he was never afraid to put a shift in, never afraid to be there at the weekend watching the sports teams. Even if his son wasn't playing, always there. And I've always took that with me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Simon was absolutely superb at that one. And just being around and being there and being on hand to help if you need him. So we've got humility and the importance of saying hello, who you are.
Yeah, brilliant.
And not knowing and presuming different things.
Yeah.
And we've talked about being around and making sure that you're there and able to do stuff. We talked about being away from the lights, which you've got an episode on.
Away from the lights. The
previous episode is all about the hard work that you put in that's not necessarily seen by other people.
Yeah.
What other things can we do or should we be considering in school to make sure we're on the right side of this ego, this idea of confidence and self-esteem versus arrogance and superiority?
I think we've touched on it before. Is it listen more than we speak?
Mm.
You know? No, and while it's good to be up there being a focal point, also recognizing that there are better people in the room who might actually be more expert than you. That's not a weakness.
Yeah.
But it's weird because some people perceive you not being all singing and dancing and being the center as being a weakness when it's not.
Mm.
It's recognizing that there are better people. I think it's a real strength in leadership.
Having a quiet confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
Some without doubt. Confidence doesn't need to be something that's in your face and it's always you talking. Mm. Sometimes that can be guiding somebody else to make the right decision.
And that's where that word charisma has got positive and negative connotations, hasn't it, as well?
I'm going to leave us with a little story.
Go on then.
The year would have been about, what we're talking, Manchester United had just played in Europe. And there's three people being interviewed by the ITV interviewer after the game. Okay. Anderson, Rio Ferdinand and Ronaldo.
Okay.
So you're probably talking maybe early 2000s, probably about 20 years ago now. Maybe in touch after, maybe about 2006. Let's say 2006 for the sake of the story. Ronaldo, Anderson and Rio are being interviewed, and the interviewer asks, they just played Barcelona, is Lionel Messi the best player in the world right now? And they're talking about, well, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. And they said, right, okay, we'll put you on the spot. If he's not the best player in the world, who is? And Ferdinand said Messi, I think. Anderson said Messi. And Ronaldo at that stage said, me, I am. Ronaldo was 18. Ronaldo was 18 years old, and he had the audacity at that time to say that this guy who's come through at Barcelona, who other people were suggesting is the best player in the world, was already not as good as him. He was better. And he got laughed at on camera. Anderson and Rio Ferdinand laughed at him.
Yeah.
Look at him now.
Yeah, ego, arrogance, confidence. Where does all that fit in, you know? Does it affect the way you're perceived as well? When you look at some of these top sports players, they've all got a bit about them, haven't they? But can you be right at the top of your game in business, education, without showing that bit of ego? I think today we've proved that. I think it's a mixed bag, isn't it? You need a little bit, but not too much. And it's that balance between being arrogant and being humble and having the right evidence in your pocket to show that you can do the job.
And I think the perception comes from how you treat people.
Mm.
You know, you might have all sorts of confidence, and you can treat people with respect and in line with your values, and you won't be seen as arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you could have all sorts of confidence and treat people without the respect and not in line with positive values and be seen as incredibly arrogant.
Yeah.
So I think as ever, it's important that you consider the person in the room and the person you're speaking to and how you approach your situation. And never going to please everyone.
Entirely right. Good one, mate.
See you next time.